from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. The Occupy Wall Street protests continued this week in New York, San Francisco, and other cities around the country. Some labor unions and Democratic politicians are now embracing the movement, which has higher approval ratings than Congress. In our next hour, we'll discuss the protests and talk about whether or not the lack of concrete demands will constrain the new movement, or will the protests evolve into sort of a liberal tea party, as some progressives hope. That's coming up on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson in This Morning for Michael Krasny. It started September 17th, a little notice protest movement called Occupy Wall Street. The subject of the protesters' ire, what they call the Wall Street greed and corruption of our times. We are the 99% that will no longer tolerate the corruption of the 1%, the group's website states. But what at first seemed fringy is now becoming more front page. The protests have continued on Wall Street, but they've also spread around the country to Boston, Chicago, L.A., San Francisco, and elsewhere. And yesterday, a number of major labor unions announced their support of Occupy Wall Street, including the AFL-CIO, the United Auto Workers, and the Service Employees International Union. So is this a budding movement of sorts, a left-leaning counterpoint to the Tea Party, or will this newly won attention fade away? That's our topic during this second hour of Forum today. We're joined first by Clara Jeffrey. She's the co-editor of Mother Jones, a San Francisco-based news organization, and publisher, of course, of Mother Jones magazine. Clara Jeffrey, good morning.
For having me.
Give us your sort of sense of what's going on with this group that started in a very small way in New York City 3 weeks ago and has now sort of mushroomed out.
That's right. It started actually with an appeal from Adbusters, which is a Vancouver, Canada-based magazine that considers itself to be preoccupied by culture jamming. And at its beck and call, some activists showed up in New York and started protesting as close as they could get to the stock exchange. And it took about 3 weeks for it to break into the national consciousness, particularly after some now fairly infamous police brutality or mishandling of situations, pepper spray incidents, and then, of course, 700 people being arrested on the Brooklyn Bridge. And I think what's interesting about them is their demands or their organization is still very amorphous. Adbusters called for them to come up with one demand, but this group in New York and now at maybe 40, 60 cities across the country and many hundreds of Facebook pages and so forth are working it out in a very flat hierarchy. They have these general assemblies where they discuss ideas. And that's earned them some ridicule of being, you know, the sort of everything in the kitchen sink kind of lefty group. But at the same time, the core of what they seem to be about and what certainly appeals to a larger audience is the issue of income inequality, the issue of inequality of political power.
They're described in the Nation magazine as a horizontal, autonomous, leaderless, modified, consensus-based system with roots in anarchist thought.
Yes,
when you read that, it's sort of hard to think that this is going to be this strong, budding political movement. And yet you have this situation where yesterday, a number of major unions saying, we're behind this. So do you have a sense that it is evolving into something beyond what that description would suggest?
What I like to say about Occupy Wall Street and the Occupy movement in general is the spark is not as important as the sheer amount of tinder that is out there. The sheer amount of rage over income inequality issues, over the Citizens United decision that lets corporation and wealthy individuals completely capture our political system. The rage over bailing out Wall Street on the backs of the middle class to have no substantive reforms go through. People of all descriptions, and certainly not just on the left, some of these issues are the very same issues that motivate the Tea Party. So people are really upset. And this group, and to even call it a group is probably not quite accurate, has captured the imagination. And I think it remains to be seen whether more mainstream groups can kind of recombine with it and it will take on amongst the general public.
Claire Jeffrey, co-editor of Mother Jones, the San Francisco-based news organization and publisher of Mother Jones magazine. We'll hear more from Claire over the course of our hour. But I want to go next to protester Zagim Kabir, who is camping out right now as part of Occupy San Francisco, an outgrowth of the Occupy Wall Street movement. San Francisco now one of some 60 or so cities where these protests have taken place. Zagim Kabir, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Tell me where you are right now and what you're doing.
Right now, I'm standing in front of the Federal Reserve Building in San Francisco, the 101 Market. And we have an encampment of about 100 people here. And we're still here after a massive raid by the police late last night, which resulted in arrests, attacks from the police, and the theft of all the camp's property, all the donations that were given to us by all the good supporters out there, including tents and sleeping bags.
So you're saying all of your both contributions and your sleeping bags and everything else were confiscated by the police last night?
Yes, in a very violent manner. Police were in riot gear. They had helmets on and batons. And they gave us a notice put our tents down. We put our tents down. We complied with the notice, and then eventually the police came and formed a perimeter around it, around our encampment. But before that, when the notice first came and we realized the police were beginning to make a move, we put a call out to our supporters all over the Bay Area, and lots of people came by immediately. Within a half hour, we had 50 more people show up. Within an hour, there's over 100. So we had a few hundred people here last night standing in solidarity.
And Zagim Kabir, tell us what it is you're trying to accomplish. Do you have a specific demand? Do you have a specific goal that you're trying to put forward?
The Occupy SF does not have any demands yet. I only speak as an individual that's been encamped out here since Friday. This is a leaderless, non-hierarchical movement based on direct democracy and consensus-based decision-making that takes place at the General Assembly meeting.
Well, then tell me, tell me then, if you would, just as an individual, what it is that you would like to accomplish.
Personally, I would like to see a mass awakening happen in America and around the world. I think it's already happening now. We witnessed that in the movements in Tunisia and Egypt and Tahrir Square, and then in Spain, all over Europe, and then Wisconsin, and now it's spread all over the country with the Occupy Wall Street protests that's spread all over the country. So I think a mass awakening is happening. What I also experienced here at this encampment is a very communal, collective, democratic, non-hierarchical mini-society that we are forming here, and that is very inspiring, and that has helped change and transform what I believe is possible in this world up until I started.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Zagim. I'm going to have to hold you there because we have to move on to other parts of our program. But thank you for joining us and letting us know your perspective on these issues and why it is that you're on the streets of San Francisco this morning. Zagim Kabir, thanks for being with us. We're joined now by Robert Reich, professor of public policy at the Goldman School of Public Policy, also, of course, the former labor secretary under President Bill Clinton. His latest book, Aftershock, is now available in paperback. Robert Reich, thanks for joining us.
Well, I'm delighted.
Tell us what you make of all of this. I don't know if you heard much of the person who we just had on who is protesting this morning still on the streets of San Francisco. Now 60 cities are involved in this. As you observe what's gone on over the last couple of weeks, what do you make of it?
It's too early to say that it's a movement. But undoubtedly, all of this ferment, especially in New York and now spreading elsewhere, does represent a rising discontent with the way America is treating average working people and the young. I mean, we have more inequality than we've had in this country in about 70 years. That is, the top 1% taking home a larger share of national income and wealth than we've seen since before the Great Depression. And at the same time, we've got 25 million Americans who are looking for full-time work, and an untold number of Americans who have simply given up looking for work altogether. The worst economy since the Great Depression. And finally, at the same time, corporations that are doing very well. In fact, the ratio of corporate profits to wages is the highest it has been since before the Great Depression. And, you know, you put all this together, and there certainly is room for people to feel aggrieved. The question is, will this general sense of aggrievement, this general sense of discontent coalesce and solidify into a real movement with real specific demands, and maybe kind of a left-wing populism that is roughly parallel to the right-wing populism of the Tea Party?
When we had Zygim Kabir, the protester, on a moment ago, you could tell that there wasn't yet, from his point of view at least, or from his perspective, a clearly formed a goal in mind in terms of what he would like to accomplish. But it's also worth noting, when I was watching the footage of the protest last night on the local news, I saw a retired couple, I saw a financial planner, I saw a variety of people participating. I'm curious about whether or not your sense is that this is a kind of message, although at the moment ill-formed perhaps and not very concise, that can really resonate across a pretty broad section of people.
Oh, it certainly can. I mean, all of the factors that I gave you before about concentrated wealth and income, what's happening to the middle class and the lower middle class and the working class, there is a long distinguished strain in American history of populism against the forces of Wall Street and big business that have held back everybody else. During his 1912 campaign, President Woodrow Wilson promised to wage a crusade against powers that have governed us, that have limited our developments, that have determined our lives, that have straitjacketed us. And he was talking, obviously, about big finance and big business. And then, of course, in the 1936 presidential campaign, Franklin D. Roosevelt warned against the economic royalists who had impressed the whole of society into service. So we do have a long tradition of kind of economic-based populism, particularly when the gap grows very, very wide between people at the top and everybody else, and when a lot of Americans are justifiably concerned that with all of that wealth and income at the top comes a lot of political power to entrench that wealth and income in the future.
Do you see, we've seen President Obama take a different tack in recent weeks, a more aggressive tone in more specific kinds of concerns that he's articulating, more specificity to what he wants to accomplish in terms of his jobs bill and others. Do you see any connective tissue, I guess, between how this, whatever it is, whether it's a movement or not, and how that can have a role in the upcoming 2012 campaign?
Well, it's always possible. I mean, what the president needs most of all is a lot of pressure, a lot of push from progressives that say, in effect, the truth, and that is that the jobs bill, while a small step in the right direction, is still very, very tiny relative to the size of the total problem. That jobs bill is calculated to create, at best, about 2 million jobs. Well, again, there are 25 million Americans who are looking for full-time work right now, 14 million who are out of work and unemployed, and the rest who are underemployed, who are working in part-time jobs. They'd rather be having rather have full-time jobs. And at the same time, you've got a large number of Americans who have given up looking for work altogether. So the jobs bill is too small. And even then, Republicans are saying, no, we don't want to vote for it. And even some Senate Democrats are less enthusiastic. So the president needs very strong mobilization, an energized and organized constituency of people who say, we want even more with regard to jobs, and we want the federal government to take a much more active and aggressive role in the worst economy since the Great Depression.
Robert Reich, professor of public policy at the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California, former labor secretary, of course, under President Bill Clinton. His latest book, Aftershock, is now available in paperback. I know you have to leave us shortly, but a last observation from you, Secretary Reich, on what you make of the union activity in the last 24 hours that the AFL-CIO, the UAW, SEIU, others sort of joining ranks, at least to a degree, with this particular, again, I don't know quite what to call it, movement, as you suggest, may be an overstatement, but lending their endorsement to it.
Well, it makes a lot of sense from the standpoint of politics and also economic policy. I mean, unions in the private sector are down to about 7% of the total employment base. That is, only 7% of workers are unionized, which is the lowest it's been since, by comparison, in 1955, one-third of American workers were unionized. And in the 1950s, so many people were unionized that they had the bargaining leverage they needed to get a higher share of corporate profits. These days, with so few people who are unionized, unionized workers have very little bargaining power. In fact, the total, if you want to take a kind of a larger view of the problem, it's that American workers as a whole have very little bargaining leverage these days, and with unemployment so high, they even have less bargaining leverage. So it makes a lot of sense for the union, which we used to call a union movement. People don't call it that anymore, but the union movement or union organized labor to join with the protesters and say, look, things are completely out of balance in this country right now in terms of the extraordinary concentration of income and wealth and also political power at the top. And the rest of America, particularly the middle class, the lower middle class, the poor and the working class, being left out, essentially drawing on the line with very little hope for things getting better. We're talking now fundamentally, potentially, that is, about the allocation of power in society. And that's, after all, what most great social movements have been focusing on and have focused on in our history. Too early to tell whether this is a movement, too early to tell whether and what kind of impact this is going to have.
Robert Reich, again, professor of public policy at the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Robert Reich, thanks so much for being part of our program.
Thank you. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Joining us in addition now is David Meyer. He's professor of sociology, political science, and planning, policy, and design at the University of California, Irvine. His books include The Politics of Protest, Social Movements in America. Professor Meyer, thanks for being with us.
I'm glad to talk with you.
If you could give us your sense of this question that Robert Reich was describing about whether or not he wasn't sure yet about whether or not this could be called a movement. What's your take on that? Is it yet a movement?
Well, right now the occupiers have demonstrated the space for a social movement in the United States on the left end of the political spectrum.
Sorry, you're breaking up a bit. Let me just ask if you're seeing, when you say it has the space, does that mean that that's a space that it can grow into?
The occupiers are already there, and they're not the only people trying to be there. They've created a space for lots of people to make claims about economic inequality. And the way those claims are appearing is very different across the country. So in Wall Street, you've seen a lot of trade unions involved, and they're making claims about education and about transportation and about government investment. When you listen to what the occupiers are saying, and when you look at we are the 99%, you can see common threads that could make for a larger progressive agenda. So the individual stories talk about student debt. They talk about unemployment and underemployment. They talk about the failure to get health insurance. This is old school left liberal progressivism, and there's an agenda there that people could unify around.
There was a lot of comment initially about how amorphous this was, that there wasn't clarity about what their goals were, that in some ways it was easy to sort of be dismissive of what this represented. As you have looked at social movements as they've begun and grown over time, is that always the case? I mean, would it also be fair to say that there's always early on a kind of amorphous quality to how these groups develop?
Well, when people get involved in social movements, they bring a variety of different motivations. If you look at the American Revolution, to start with an old social movement in American history, there were people who wanted to use the revolution to abolish slavery, for example. That was not the thing that wound up commanding the majority support, but that was an element in the revolutionary campaign. So in this social movement, there are people with a wide variety of demands. That's normal. And as the movement evolves, if it becomes a movement, some claims will come to the center and some claims will get put on the back burner to the disappointment of some activists. And I mean, I think we need to remember that the big, visible, important social movements in American life have always asked for more than what they've gotten. The 1963 March on Washington was for jobs, peace, and justice. And what they got was a civil rights bill and a voting rights act, and those were important things, but they were less than what many of the activists were demanding.
David Meyer, professor of sociology, political science, and planning, policy, and design at the University of California, Irvine, joining us as we talk about this new and interesting movement. If that's not the right word, then we'll ask for your calls and what you think this is coming up in the second part of our program. Do you have a sense, Claire Jeffrey, also joining us, co-editor of Mother Jones here in San Francisco, about whether or not there are parallels to the Tea Party movement? Again, that word. Is there a commonality at all in how the Tea Party also originated just not so very long ago?
Well, if you'll remember that the Tea Party too started out as a pretty non-hierarchical, not really led by any one group of people, starting with the town halls over healthcare reform, but then powerful parties and the conservative media kind of put their wind behind it, put some real organization into it, or some would say co-opted parts of what they wanted. So, you know, it too was a very broad, non-hierarchical movement, but that then congealed with a sort of more established power structure.
I confess, David Meyer, and we're coming up on a break, so just a short thought and then we'll come back to you on this, that I didn't see what the Tea Party would become when that first bloomed a while back. Is that perhaps something that we could fall victim to here again, that we're not sort of giving this its due?
I think we're giving it a lot of due now.
Yeah.
And I think we've been pretty late to come to the story. And, you know, most of the big left groups were wary about the Occupy effort. And then when it demonstrated some staying power, they tried to get in on it.
David Meyer, again, professor of sociology and political science at the University of California, Irvine. His books include The Politics of Protest, Social Movements in America. He's joined by Claire Jeffrey, co-editor of Mother Jones, the San Francisco-based news organization and publisher of Mother Jones magazine. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll take your calls. What do you make of the Occupy Wall Street activity and its attempt to now go beyond Wall Street? There have now been protests in some 60 different cities around the country, including here in San Francisco yesterday. Is it something that resonates with you? Do you see it as being something that can grow and have an impact on the political campaign of 2012? Join us at 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org or go to our Facebook page and post your comments there. Back in just a moment. This is Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson in this morning for Michael Krasny. Our topic, the Occupy Wall Street protests that began in New York 3 weeks ago, have now spread to some 60 different cities around the country, including a protest that was held here in San Francisco yesterday. Our guests include Clara Jeffrey, the co-editor of Mother Jones, a San Francisco-based news organization, and David Meyer, professor of sociology, political science, and planning, policy, and design at the University of California, Irvine. We're interested in getting your views on what you make of the Occupy Wall Street activity, what it means to you, whether or not it resonates with you as something that touches on concerns that you have. 866-733-6786 is our number. Forum at kqed.org is the email address. We're also joined now by Anca Siu. She is a member of the media and information team for the Occupy Wall Street effort, and she joins us now from New York. Anca, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
Tell us what you're doing right now and what things look like on the streets of New York.
They look crowded. New York is a wonderful city, and this movement that is, I think, absolutely organic, and it started spontaneously in a way. There was absolutely no planning, no agenda really behind it. It's flourishing, and we do have lots of support. But it's also very important not to identify it as a left or whatever. I've listened a little bit to what the people were saying before me. It's a workshop in democracy, really, on the ground. I joined on day 11. Local media did not cover it. I found out about this via Twitter and other social media sites. People are angry. They're not violent, but they're angry.
Anca, we're going to ask you, if you could, to try to call back. We're going to try to clean up your line because it's breaking up a lot. So let's see if we can get you on a better line, and then we'll include more of your comments, because the point you're just making about whether or not it's left or not is an important one. We'd like to get your views. So we'll work on that and come back to you in just a moment. A couple of emails coming in. Tian in Mountain View writes, I was at the Occupy San Jose thing last Sunday. One thing that struck me was that when someone asked for a show of hands on the question, how many people know someone that has been kicked out of their home by foreclosure, at least a third of the people there stuck up their hands. That represents a lot of decentralized anger out there. Comment from our website, the media keeps looking for demands and specifics. I think the protesters are still deciding if they want reform or a revolution. Another comment, although I agree and support the protesters, I don't think Wall Street and corporate America could care less. The most effective approach would be for every protester to buy one share of stock in the most egregious companies, use their proxy votes to oust the board of directors and CEOs. And Paul writes in, please remind listeners that anarchism does not mean no rules, but rather no rulers. Ideally, it functions as a true participatory democracy. Some comments coming in early in this hour as we talk about this topic. Let's take a caller. David joins us next in San Jose. David, go ahead. In Sunnyvale, rather. David, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I think one of the problems is trying to centralize the message and try to, reduce it to one soundbite. I mean, there are lots of issues that you just mentioned, and most of it, I think the general feeling is an overall lack of power that's been diminished. You look at it in wages. Robert Reich just pointed out where union membership is diminished, and those benefits to non-union members that come about as well. You look at people like Ron Paul, who offer market solutions, but then you see that corporations have much power that they can change the market forces. For example, look at here in Silicon Valley with workers, the supply and demand has changed with the inclusion of so many IT workers imported on H-1B. So that changes the market rules for regular workers. Essentially, if there is a bottom line, and it's across the board, not just financially, it's that individuals have lost power to corporations.
Yeah, overall. David. Yeah, no, thank you for the observation. It reminds me of something that Ezra Klein wrote in the Washington Post the other day, and I'd like both David Meyer and Clara Jeffrey to respond to this about what this is about. And Ezra Klein wrote this, what gives the movement the potential for power and potency is the masses who just want the system to work the way it was supposed to work. It's not that 99% of Americans are really struggling. It's not that 99% of Americans want revolution. It's that 99% of Americans sense that the fundamental bargain of our economy, work hard, play by the rules, get ahead, has been broken, and they want to see it restored. Claire Jeffrey, your thoughts on sort of what this is about and what that 99% figure really represents.
Well, I think Ezra is exactly right. I mean, it is the case that that there's been a change in the balance of power. It's in part due to union membership diminishment, which is, you know, not something that just happened. And unions served a purpose to non-union members of kind of establishing a floor below which wages wouldn't fall, below which benefits wouldn't be cut. And that was true for everybody. But it's also things like the Citizens United decision and the
campaign finance
the decision. Campaign finance decision, which basically has, you know, has declared that corporations are people, corporate personhood, and so therefore have the right to sort of flood elections with as much money as they want. I think what's really at the core of what's really motivating people is just this sense of unfairness. I mean, the richest 1% of Americans control, and this is before the crash, so that it's even more concentrated now, but control 2/3 of the net worth in the country. You know, when you talk about why young people are involved, student loan debt has quintupled since 2000. And student loan debt now exceeds all credit card debt. I mean, that's crazy. And when you look at just, you know, the past 100 years, we have more income inequality now than ever before. As a sort of marker of this, we published a bunch of charts called It's the Inequality Stupid several months ago, and those have just gone completely viral. 5 million people have looked at them. The protesters in of the Occupy movement and in Wisconsin passed them around, projected them on buildings. Just the sheer numbers are amazing.
Claire Jeffrey, co-editor of Mother Jones. Anca Siu rejoins us. She is part of the Occupy Wall Street effort. Is that what is at its heart for you, what's motivating you, Anca, this sense of inequality?
Yes. It's not necessarily political. My political views are completely inappropriate, actually, at this time. This is a workshop in democracy. Our muscles have been atrophied. We haven't been saying anything about what's been happening, about the unfairness that was just mentioned before. And I'll tell you specifically for me what the story was when I went in to join. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Half of the streets in New York are occupied by banks. The other half by pharmacies. We have changed. The landscape has changed in the past, I would say, I don't know, 5 to 7 years. And we don't have a community anymore. We don't have the small business anymore. The little shop that I used to go to in the East Village where I'd sit down and the waiter would ask me, do you want your usual? It's a much more, I don't know, philosophical, I think, movement at the core of this. It's not necessarily political. There's no politics at the level of the ground level in Liberty Plaza. Nobody's talking about the elections or any of this stuff.
Yeah.
It's wonderful that unions have come and joined, but it has to stay, I think, a movement of kind of an exercise in democracy that's happening in a place that's sandwiched between Ground Zero and Wall Street.
Anca Siu again with the Occupy Wall Street movement in New York, adding her perspective as to what motivates her and why she is part of this effort. Anca, thanks very much for adding your point of view to this. David Meyer, I'd love to get your response to what Anca was just saying, that it's really about this broader sense of democracy and culture in a way, about the kind of neighborhood that she'd like to make, and very explicitly saying that for her, at least, it's not political.
Well, that may not be what motivates Anca to participate, and the workshop in democracy is something that I am sure is invigorating and inspiring to people on the ground. The responses to an effective movement, however, will be political responses. The occupiers have demonstrated huge dissatisfaction and concern with the way the economy and the government are not working for them. And what we'll see now is politicians and larger interest groups trying to respond. So after the Occupy Wall Street movement grew, Harry Reid said, well, why don't we fund the jobs bill with a millionaire's tax?
Huh.
That's a response to Occupy Wall Street. The activist's job is to set the agenda. And they're doing a good job of that so far. And I'm sure that it will develop over time.
Claire Jeffrey.
That's right. I mean, ultimately, it sort of must break out of the paraprofessional protester group. And a lot of the people that are involved now are people who are involved in other movements. And so there is this diffuse sense of what they want. But the sort of core economic and political message there is just it's not fair what's going on.
I guess what I'm wondering about in part is what the bumper sticker will be out of this. As you were referencing before, Claire Jeffrey, with Tea Party, you know, there was this healthcare bill, unconstitutional. You could sort of get your arms around it in a heartbeat. This is tougher to do.
Yes, although I think that we are the 99% does really, I mean, that is specifically tied to an income inequality stat, that the people at the tippy top are not just getting rich, they're hoovering the money out of the rest of us. And so when you go to that Tumblr and you see people who basically are holding a letter up in front describing their situation, it's incredibly powerful. And I do think that there is this sense that there are these very few people and their minions in Congress who are basically concentrating all the wealth and power in this country.
Let's hear what our listeners are thinking about. Brian joins us in Ohio. Truck driver. Brian, go ahead, please.
Brian, I'm 45 years old. I'm a truck driver. I pulled over because I thought this was important to talk about. I'm taking days off because I think it's I want to put boots on the ground. I've been giving money to the, to the food and various things, trying to, bolster a little bit, but I feel like, you know, I want to be a part of it. So I'm actually, taking days off. I'm leaving, tomorrow to head up to Washington to the October 2011, rally, which, has very similar goals. Essentially the message that I feel like that me and others want to get across is that we've been snookered. We want the money out of politics because it seems to be corrupting the politicians to not work for the people. We want the politicians who have worked tirelessly for corporations and for the wealthy to start making those same efforts for the people.
I just am curious about whether or not you have at this point something specific that you'd like to see happen. Clear about what is concerning you, motivating you, taking you to Washington, D.C. Is there something that you want to see happen?
Well, in Washington, D.C., like I said, it's a little different. It was originally to bring the troops back home from Afghanistan, which I think is very important and also would help aid the economy. But specifically, I think I want to see some perhaps an amendment movement to get money out of politics, to over, you know, to the Citizens United ruling needs to not stand. It needs to be gone. You know, I think that and also, you know, corporate welfare, you know, that are some of the a couple of the main, you know, to me, the main goals.
Brian,
you know,
thanks.
We need income equality. And that means that everybody should be paying a handout. We want equal opportunity and access to education and to jobs and to the prosperity.
Oh, I think we're losing you, Brian, but thanks. Thanks for joining us along the road in Ohio. Brian, thanks for making that call. Let's hear next from Victor. Victor, go ahead, please.
Hi. I also just pulled over. I run a think tank for social movements in the Presidio called International Forum on Globalization. And we've been very involved in these issues for years, going back to Seattle with the WTO protests. And what we see here on Wall Street is really the potential to become sort of a Seattle on steroids. Yesterday, when we saw the Marines marching with the peaceful protesters, this is definitely a new day dawning in America. A couple points. One, on the Tea Party, this is definitely from the progressive left, what you see happening in Wall Street. What's different than the Tea Party is the Tea Party is bankrolled by the Koch brothers. And Mother Jones has done excellent reporting on this. Yes, it's spontaneous and decentralized and so on, but there is no billionaire on the side of this protest that has totally enabled the Tea Party. And people can Google Tea Party Billionaire Party. Billionaire's Tea Party, and there's a fantastic video that shows all of this.
Okay.
Secondly,
go ahead, Victor.
There is agenda setting to happen, and if there's a specific, it's too much power in too few hands, and that's how we see a lot of these issues coming together.
All right, Victor, thanks. Thanks for the call. Paul joins us next in San Francisco. Paul, go ahead.
Yes, if I was in the march yesterday, if there is going to be a bumper sticker, it'll probably be, we need a four-day work week. I see this as a historical event, similar to back in the 1880s when the work week shifted from the 60-hour work week to a 40-hour work week. The best way to share jobs is to give everybody a four-day work week. Right now, the courts where I work are going broke, and so the clerks are considering a four-day work week. I talked to Judge Feinstein, who's got some say-so in what happens, and proposed to her that instead of firing 400 clerks, why not give everybody a four-day work week? That way, everybody has a little bit of pain instead of some people losing their jobs.
Paul, thanks. Referring, I think, to Judge Feinstein, the senior judge here in San Francisco County. Let's get one more call, and then we'll get some reaction from David Meyer and Claire Jeffrey. Jack joins us next in Davis. Jack, go ahead.
Hey, I just thought if you want a bumper sticker, it should be Occupy All Streets. I'm a retired guy who graduated from UC Davis's grad program in 1980 and was paying $247 a quarter to go to school. Now it's upwards of $4,000 a quarter. Mm. And I think the idea that a corporate leader like the guy who just left Hewlett-Packard, his payoff was some like $23 million for 11 months of running the corporation into the hole. And I think that that's the kind of greed that we're seeing that it will eventually spread across the entire country. And so if the country's so big, we really need to have it be Occupy All Streets, not just Occupy Wall Street.
Jack, thanks. Thanks for the observation. Clara and David Meyer, your reactions to what you're hearing from people. Claire Jeffrey?
I'm going to go all the way back to caller Brian when he said that he felt that politicians weren't responsive. Actually, to the interests of working class people, that's documentable. We wrote an article a few months back by Kevin Drum that was based on research some political scientists had done, and it showed that Republican senators were not at all responsive to the needs of working class and middle class American, but Democratic senators were only a tiny bit better. So this is really the influence that money has in our political system, that with the onset of Citizens United decision is just going to get worse. And I also think that this has the potential of being the first movement, perhaps since the 1930s, to take on the core issue of economic stability for most Americans. If I were creating its bumper sticker, that's where I'd drive people to concentrate their efforts.
I should note, since I'm the one who tossed out the bumper sticker idea, I'm not trying to suggest that this ought to be reduced or that any movement is reduced to a bumper sticker. I guess because it's had its roots, David Meyer, in this sort of amorphous quality, which is perhaps how all actions like this begin. I'm just curious about what it will centralize around. And I guess I'm interested then in hearing from you, David, about what you're hearing from people and about whether or not anything is kind of becoming more distilled as you listen to listeners participating this morning.
Well, I mean, as I listen to listeners participating, people are coming back to money and politics and money and government, and they're looking for the government and the economy to work for them. And there are lots of different ways to do this, but that's going to be the core that unifies what's going on. And I think the potential for growth here is quite extensive. So the Tea Party polls an intense 30% support of Americans on a routine basis, but never much more than that.
Mm-hmm.
Ideas like progressive taxation or jobs bills or universal health care always poll way more than 50% support. The potential for growth is very strong. I want to say something else here. The Tea Party said government's not responding to regular Americans like us, and they put pictures of other kinds of Americans, mostly older and white, into the news doing things that we usually don't think about them doing. The Occupy Wall Street movement and the Occupy movement all over the United States is showing we're America also, and we're younger and a little more colorful. And that's part of what America is all about as well.
Tony in Colorado has our next observation. Tony, go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air, Tony. Go ahead, please.
Okay. Although the
protesters have some extraordinarily valid points, such as the apparent manipulation on Wall Street and the workers in America probably do not get a particularly fair deal. I really have a problem with the way they use foreclosures as one of their platforms. It seems to me that foreclosures really knocks their credibility, considering that they signed a contract, they probably paid less than 10% down on a property that belongs to somebody else, they stopped payments, and then the argument is that they were kicked out of their house. I don't think they were kicked out of their house. I think they were removed from somebody else's property, which they stopped paying for.
Tony, thanks. Interesting observation. Clara, that the foreclosure reference also came about earlier from someone who protested in San Jose yesterday, saying that there were a third of the crowd raised their hands if they knew someone who had been foreclosed. Tony's making the point that that's not necessarily the best calling card because these are people who didn't make appropriate payments.
Well, I mean, and there are probably a small number of people who kind of took advantage of that situation. But if you have banks in our entire economy and our media as well, basically telling you that you not only have the right, but you deserve to have a house that's bigger and fancier and that, hey, you don't need to put any money down and only a sucker would do that. I mean, it was a lot of snake oil being sold by a lot of people. There was self-delusion aplenty. By home buyers, but also by bankers, and that's being charitable to the bankers. But, you know, and I think if one third of the people who raise their hand know someone who's been foreclosed on, that number would probably go up to near 100% if you know someone whose house is underwater or who can't move because they can't sell their house. They were told for generations that the thing to do to raise net worth and to raise equity was to buy a home and put money into your home. And that's all gone away right when nobody has a pension anymore.
Let me go through a couple of emails that have come in from our website. One person writes in, as a participant in yesterday's protests, I must say that this seems to be a very exciting movement. It appears that this could be a good start to the American Spring, as the participants came from all walks of life, and this movement is quite inclusive. Another comment, I support this movement because besides ruining our economy, the banks and publicly listed companies pay top management a disproportionate amount of profits compared to shareholders. If I was a shareholder and can't share in the profits, what's the point? David Meyer, it always interests me that this issue of the disproportionate amount that people make in some of these companies doesn't seem to – I mean, it may resonate, but it never seems to get anywhere. Harry Reid is proposing today that the jobs bill be paid for by a surcharge on millionaires. And yet that won't go anywhere, even though there seem to be plenty of people, like the people who are writing in, who have that sense of things. Help us understand that, why there might be popular support for something, but it never works its way through the political process.
I don't think that's right. I think that in American history, the top tax rates on biggest earners have changed dramatically over the years. They've been as high as 90%. Right now it's 36%. It's lower now than it's ever been. And to say that we'd like to restore a top bracket to something closer to what it was in the Eisenhower era seems like a totally viable way to make claims. Now, there's absolutely no question that the way the political system is set up, people who are high earners have more power and more voice in what happens in Congress. But the notion of democratic capitalism is that mobilized people are supposed to be able to provide a counterbalance for that. And historically, at certain times in American history, they have.
Yeah, I guess what I'm trying to get at, and Claire Jeffrey, weigh in on this too, please, is that there seems to be, if you look at polling, a lot of support for some of these ideas, and yet they haven't made headway, at least in the last few years.
For a number of reasons, but one is just self-interest. I mean, the odds of being a millionaire if you're in Congress is 1 in 2. Mitch Romney the other day said that he was a member of the middle class. And if Mitch Romney is a member of the middle class, then we're all doing, starvation wages. So I think part of it is this sort of capture by moneyed interest in Congress. Wealthy people have always served in Congress, but I think that disproportionate number of them in there, and then also that they that in order to stay there, whether they are personally wealthy or not, they just have to court so much money and so much corporate money.
Let's get one more quick comment in. James in San Leandro, I'm sorry, we just have a brief moment. James, a quick thought, please.
Sure. So I just wanted to say that I was at the Fed yesterday testifying in a hearing about Capital One acquiring ING Bank, and it was just striking that Capital One, which is a subprime credit card company and is ripping people off on fees on their deposit accounts, was proudly talking about how they've been profitable through the downturn on all those fees. You know, I was in there sort of making some points about that, but thinking that the protesters outside might really be onto something, because it seems like such a marginal effect we can have on what the policymakers are doing. Maybe this movement really is, it's ripe for that. I think it's interesting to juxtapose the inside versus outside actions that we're going to defend yesterday.
Okay, James, thank you. Thanks for that thought. Coming to the end of our hour, I guess I'm curious to know, David Meyer, as someone who studies social movements, what you'll be watching for as this evolves in the months ahead.
I'm going to be looking to see who picks up on the momentum of the occupiers, and I'm going to be looking at the responses that people who are closer to institutional politics offer to the anger and mobilization that the occupiers have demonstrated. And I think we have to remember that before a social movement takes place, it's always hard to imagine the extent of influence it's going to affect.
And your hunch as to whether or not it will have that much influence?
I think it's already having some influence in Harry Reid's speech. I think it's something that we have to watch for, and I think the prospects for large change are very great.
David Meyer, professor of sociology, political science, and planning, policy, and design at the University of California, Irvine. His books include The Politics of Protest, Social Movements in America. Professor Meyer, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Claire Jeffrey joins us as well. She is co-editor of Mother Jones, the San Francisco-based news organization and publisher of Mother Jones magazine. Claire, thanks for being with us as well.
Thanks so much for having me.
We heard earlier from Robert Reich as well, professor of public policy at the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley, and two protesters who are part of the Occupy effort. Danny Bringer is our engineer, Dan Zoll, our senior editor. I'm Dave Iverson. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.